The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, traveling is often associated with Christmas and New Year's holidays. It's a time to visit with families and friends and perhaps to exchange gifts and create some new memories for seasons to come. In the October-November 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler, the editors include a section titled Women and Adventure Travel Lessons. It is a series of six short articles about six countries written by six women who share some special gifts from their travels. As the headline reads, "To see the world is a gift. To love the world is a choice." Well, our first writer is Anne Farrar, National Geographic Travel's Director of Photography, and she challenges us to tread lightly and be open to awe as she shares her experiences in Australia. While most guests at the Lady Elliot Island Eco Resort off the coast of Queensland were pouring their first cup of coffee, a few of us were donning wetsuits and grabbing masks, fins, and snorkels, then walking 10 minutes to the far side of the island for a sunrise swim. Peter Gash, the island's tireless steward, was the instigator of this early morning meditation that started with a shock of cold as we eased into the pink-tinted waters. Floating face down above corals that formed the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef, we drifted alongside Gash, who pointed out underwater wonders, clownfish, moon wrasse, parrotfish, painted flute mouth, angelfish, white-banded triggerfish. A reef shark coasted by, ignoring our excited gesturing as we made sure none in our small group missed the sighting. A sea turtle popped its head up before dipping back down to find an outcropping of coral in which to scratch its shell. The crystalline water was a miracle in itself. It wasn't always this way. Before I arrived at Lady Elliot Island, what I knew of the 1,400-mile-long Great Barrier Reef was a narrative of devastating coral bleaching that heralded its imminent death. Lady Elliot Island itself, named in 1816 by Captain Thomas Stewart aboard the ship of the same name, was a guano-rich island mined for a decade in the 1800s, its fish and turtles depleted. Around 1873, stripped of its resources, the island was abandoned to the sun and shifting winds. In 1969, Australian aviator Don Adams built an airstrip and accommodations, started replanting the island, and over time created a no-frills resort. The torch was taken up by fellow Australian pilot Gash, who brought solar power, desalinization, and composting to the island. He firmly established a remote resort, now 40-plus cottages and glamping tents, many of which open directly onto the white sand beach, as a leader in a sustainable tourism, a model for other resorts along the Great Barrier Reef. Lady Elliot Island is especially known for manta rays and participates in Project Manta, a research program based at the University of Queensland, Brisbane. Researchers have used the island as a home base for studying the manta's migration, behavior, and health. May is the early season for mantas, and as I bobbed in the waters of a new day, I hoped to get a glimpse of one. It wasn't until we turned back toward shore that we all heard someone yell, "Ray!" Mast slapped down into the water. The manta, spanning more than 15 feet, hovered at a cleaning station so Ras could groom its gills and fins. We hovered above the surface, wishing we too had gills so we could glide as effortlessly in exploring the ocean's depths. Lady Elliot Island and its surrounding reef system prove that the story of the Great Barrier Reef doesn't need to have a tragic ending. When people fall in love with a place and make a conscious effort to protect it, we glimpse a sustainable future where we can all keep dipping our heads underwater and experience awe. Well, next we're going to go with the flow and embrace the unexpected with Kate Seiber, a Colorado-based freelance writer who tells us about her time in Indonesia. I first learned about the wonders of Raja Ampat from my friend Tanya Burnett, who has logged thousands of dives all over the world. It's an underwater photographer's dreamscape, she told me. The reefs just explode with color and life. It's almost overwhelming for some. It has been number one on my bucket list ever since. Recently, Tanya told me of some last-minute spaces that opened up on a charter she was leading. I persuaded my husband to splurge, and that's how we found ourselves on the Pendito, a traditional-style Indonesian schooner with 15 other divers. Not long after the boat leaves the West Papua port of Sarang, the landscape becomes streamlined. Standing on the bow, I can only see water and sky and small green islets. The swirling clouds stage a melodrama overhead, but nothing disrupts the tranquility. As beautiful as it is, I harbor a feeling of anticipation. I have come expressly to see something that presently remains hidden, one of the world's greatest collections of marine biodiversity. The next morning, laden with dive gear, I sink under the surface of the sea and a fantasy of marine creatures comes into view. Huge shrimp preside over the reef, their antenna reaching out in all directions. A school of surgeonfish moves like a cloud until a shark plows through, sending them scattering like wisps of smoke. At times, there are so many fish I can barely see through the water. Over 10 days, the Pendito motors 800 nautical miles across the upper Banda Sea, stopping at reefs 3 or 4 times a day. It seems impossible that the trip could live up to my expectations, but each dive serves up new wonders, a manta swooping overhead, a solitary dolphin rolling around playfully on a reef, giant schools of snapper and fusiliers swirling around us like tornadoes, and venomous sea crates wafting through sunlit water. The landscape is mostly sea, but we occasionally stop on shore. One day, we clamber through a limestone cave and scamper down a dark hole to discover a room with a clear, serene pool. Naturally, we jump in, floating on our backs, suspended in the stillness. Later in the journey, we motor to Banda Neira in the Spice Islands. The once rare nutmeg trees that dot this verdant idyll lured Dutch traders who brutalized the residents and built a thick stone fortress in the 1600s. Now, locals sell the spices in fragrant markets. Most of the time, however, we are in the water. Among the great delights of diving is never knowing what will appear. One day, floating after a dive, Tanya spots what looks like dolphins. "No! Pilot whales!" she yells. "Come on!" We scramble into the dinghy and race over to them. I'm not sure if these toothed whales are safe to swim with, but before I know it, Tanya is slipping over the side of the boat like a seal. My husband and I look at each other and follow suit. When I gaze down, my fear evaporates. Hundreds of sleek whales indolate in unison around and above us. I have never felt at once so present and alive as if the boundary between human and animal thinned for just a few minutes. On the surface again, Tanya tells us that they were in fact melon-headed whales, an elusive ocean-going relative of the pygmy killer whale. Even the Pendito's owner and captain had never had the opportunity to swim with them. Some places can surpass even the greatest of expectations. Writer Manisha Rajis is a London-based author, and she encourages us to have faith in the kindness of strangers as she shares her time and experiences in China. A vase of synthetic red tulips shuddered on the table as the train sped along uneven ground. Steadying my flask of jasmine tea, I held back the window curtain and peered out at the expanse of sand reddening in the soft evening light. Then I noticed the embroidered image on the lace curtain. 3 Bactrian camels, double-humped and furry, mountains peaking in the background. It wasn't dissimilar to the scene outside deep in northwest China's Xinjiang province. As the warm smell of wok-fried mutton and chili drifted from the dining car, I ducked out of my compartment, threading between passengers who nodded and nudged me in the right direction. I'd been warned not to travel here. According to China's state-run press, it was far too dangerous for foreigners due to unrest. Despite warnings, I had no other way to continue by rail from mainland China through Kazakhstan and Russia, partly along the old Silk Route, then eventually back to my home in London. And I was determined not to let anyone stop me, or anything. Within hours of my arrival in the city of Turfan, I found the Turkic-speaking Muslim Uyghur community gentle and welcoming, inviting me into their family-run cafes to try bone broth that glistened, fat, chewy noodles, and mutton skewers cooked on sidewalk grills. Chinese soldiers roamed the streets. From the closed-circuit cameras placed on mosques and the enforced restriction on beards and headscarves to the patrolling tanks, a feeling of unease permeated the city. Saddened to leave Turfan, the new high-speed service to Amrunchu, which connects the two cities in just over an hour, and found a distinct absence on board the Uyghur passengers, most of whom were forbidden from traveling freely within the region. Finding an empty table, I sat down as a Buddhist nun with a shaved head ran up to me, laughing. Flummoxed, I strained to catch a few words from her stream of chatter and eventually extracted Indian. A fellow passenger translated, explaining that she was curious as to whether or not I was Indian, and I confirmed that I was indeed of Indian ethnicity. Thrilled, the nun clapped, slapped her thighs, sat down, swinging her feet like a child. I learned that the nun was excited to meet someone of my origin, as India had become to the rescue, rather, of the Dalai Lama, and she was grateful. The nun had fled Tibet, and unable ever to return, she had made her home near Umraki. Joyfully, the nun pored over my photos from the Pachala Palace in Lhasa, scrolling through each one with concentration before realizing her stop was approaching. Pulling out a gold iPhone, she gestured to me to add her as a contact on WeChat, the multi-purpose ubiquitous Chinese messaging app. Unsure what to do, I handed over my phone and she showed me how to scan her QR code. As the train slowed into the station, she tied a thin red string around my wrist, wrapped herself in robes, picked up her bag, and waving as she jumped down the steps. When the train began to roll from the platform, I felt a vibration in my hand and looked down to see a message from the nun, a gif of a laughing Buddha exploding in light. Well, from China, we're going to head to Sweden, where California-based writer Jill K. Robinson urges us to move with intention and enjoy the freedom. My paddle breaks the silvery skin of the Baltic Sea. Water drips off the blades. Ahead lie a constellation of rocky islands, and the sea extending to the horizon. It feels as if there are no boundaries. Buffering Sweden's capital from the Baltic Sea, the islands of the Stockholm Archipelago, called the Skagerrak, are a wonderland of rocks, skerries, and islets with pine forests, fields of wildflowers, and bare granite. The exact number of islands is debatable, but the general consensus is about 30,000. The archipelago stretches from downtown Stockholm and brings wilderness into the city. Although regular ferry services visit most of the larger islands, I've chosen to experience these glacier-carved isles by kayak. Exposure to nature is a central part of life in Sweden, where the country's constitution guarantees, a la Mönstraten, every man's right, a freedom to roam in natural spaces. The vast archipelago is ideal for exploration by kayak because one can linger among the quiet coves and passages. Only 40 minutes by ferry from the mainland, Uuto provides a quick transition to island time. Once an active mining community with some of the oldest iron mines in the country, the island of about 250 people and only a few cars is known today for its beaches, restaurants, and the famed Uuto dark rye bread that tastes of molasses and anise. The bread makes an appearance nearly everywhere, including a seasonal fish restaurant, Bat Shaket. Hungry visitors arrive by boat or bike, claim a spot on the deck, and enjoy smoked salmon and shrimp on rye while letting the brief but intoxicating Swedish summer sun soak into their skin. Nobody rushes to leave, and time slows to accommodate even the napping dogs. Despite having a tent in my pack, I find a cottage at Uuto Vorthus with a view of the island's main harbor. At the tail end of summer, families are starting to head home for work and school, but many are enjoying one last summer fling. The next day, called to the sea, I pack my dry bag. My guide, Mats Anderson, and I launch our kayaks at Soldier Flynn, a small south-facing bay halfway down the island's central. Grubin, Mats lives on Uto and has paddled among many of the islands in the archipelago, often kayaking between Uto and Stockholm. For a skilled paddler, it can take 8 hours, but for intermediate folk, it's easier as a two-day trip from the Swedish capital. A watery obstacle course, the bay is scattered with skerries or rocky isles. After navigating the passage through two small islands, Brunskar and Landskar, we're no longer in these sheltered waters. Far out in the southern part of the archipelago, Uto isn't protected on its south shore, and we encounter choppy seas as we paddle toward the island's northern tip. The brackish water splashes my arms and face, and I learn to focus exclusively on my body's actions. Paddle, breathe, like a seafaring meditation. As we pass through the waves, I notice the landscape at Uto's edge. Granite boulders with green, gold lichen, curve down to the water. Plants and trees hesitate higher up in the incline, and if too shy to dip a toe into the sea. We break for a picnic on the islands of Melankadbarna and settle in among a low shrub, ferns, and rosy pink flowers that Mats identifies as the Jablomster. Between the bites, he schools me on the rights of Allemansdrotten. Aside from the requirement not to disturb or destroy, people can forage, catch fish, swim in lakes, visit beaches, set up a tent, and access any land as long as they stay out of private gardens and maintain the stipulated 70 meters, 229 feet, from a dwelling. With so many islands in the archipelago, it seems that everyone can establish camp in their own space, far from other nature lovers. But what happens when more than one group chooses to enjoy the same space? When you want a small island to yourself, my father has decided that the naked stretch is the best way to encourage others to choose a different site, says Mats. He stands within view, without clothes, and takes a few minutes stretching. He guarantees people will go away. I scan the area to see if any boaters are eyeing our private island, but nobody's in sight. Even if there were interlopers, the island is large enough for a few more people. No need to ditch my clothes. From Melankadbarna, it's a long straight shot east to Hudvatskar, one of the archipelago's final outposts. The water out here is deep blue, and I pause as the boat drifts, silently bobbing on the surface. It's just us and the sea. In a month or two, the weather won't allow such a far-flung trip. On Hudvatskar, heather, cotton grass, and crowberry grow in rock crevices. A lighthouse rises over small red cottages, all closed up tight against the elements. There have been fishermen and hunters here for more than 700 years, but there are no longer any permanent residents on this remote rock slab. I watch gulls soar overhead and let my eyes rest on the unbroken horizon. It'll soon be time to return to Uto and eventually Stockholm. Until then, the rocky archipelago surrounds me, a shelter but not a fence, where I can roam far and free. Well, next, we're going to enjoy a journey to Belgium, where travel journalist Emma Thompson encourages us to look around. Your next adventure can be anywhere. I bought a bike and started cycling, was the response veteran Irish traveler Deborah Murphy gave me when she was asked how she planned her odyssey across India that would become the beloved travelogue, Full Tilt, Ireland to India with a bicycle. It's proof that adventure can start with a simple push of the pedal. Ghent, in the northern Flemish region of Belgium, may not be India, but it has long love affair with the bike. The city has the largest pedestrian zone in Europe, with more than 120 hectares of car-free space to roam. Sandwiched between the capital, Brussels, and the fairy tale city of Bruges, Ghent delights in being the underdog, but the city is far from being the ugly duckling of the trio. French novelist Victor Hugo described Ghent as a kind of Venice of the North, thanks to the pretty medieval twist of streets that cluster around swan-patrolled canals. Ghent isn't sleepy in the least, though. For 10 days in July, close to 2 million people turn up to enjoy a riot of free concerts and street theater known as the Ghent's Feastin'. And the green credentials extend further, too. Ghent is dubbed a vegetarian capital, and every Thursday it is a meat-free day with restaurants and cafes dishing up veggie options for all. In fact, I find Ghent as a city to be explored with legs and stomach. So after dipping into the St. Bafts Cathedral to see the famous 15th century polyptic adoration of the mystic lamb, I bump across the cobblestones and turn down onto Grasslick Way. The city's first commercial port, it's lined with ancient guild houses, and I find students cooling their ankles in the water. Then it's on to Grutton Market, home to the Tertian Verlent 229-year-old delicatessen known for its homemade mustard doled out of wooden barrels and stalls selling kubotons, local cone-shaped purple candy also known as nutskis, little noses. I pass Drupalkat, a slip of a cafe serving shots of Genever, a gin-like liquor made from malt wine in flavors ranging from garlic to grapefruit, with petal across the bridge to the medieval maze of Patashol. Once a working-class district home to brothels and dingy drinking dens, it was gentrified in the 80s and now conceals some of the most exciting and exclusive restaurants in the city. For me, biking trumps other modes of transport because you don't just see the city, you feel it. The cobblestones jutter your bones, the wind streaks your hair, scents around you, and then you can park right in front of your destination. I wend westward away from the crowds. The streets seem to fold unto themselves as if hiding a secret. I step off and gently roll the bike past Povenierstrassen. I've entered the Oud Mingelhof St. Elizabeth, a medieval community founded by pious Catholic women who wish to serve God without entering a monastery. Whitewashed cottages frame the dormouse quiet cobbled street, and the time seems to dial back centuries. I cycle back towards Petershaw for a beer at a local bar, Verlut, its wacky decor, so crime with old bikes I can barely get in the door. Bearded owner, Levin DeVos, has run this cherished spot for more than a quarter of a century. Exiting the bar, I find the city has had a costume change with all its iconic buildings lit from the ground up, ready for a whole new two-wheeled adventure. I set off into the jaws of the night. Wow. Well, Columbia is going to be our sixth and final stop, as Brooklyn-based writer Glenn Pogue wants us to see the world, or rather see that the world is big and small all at once. It would take 2 full days by car, motorcycle, bus, and van to get from Cartagena to La Guajira, the desolate northernmost point of Colombia where the desert meets the sea, so my friend Sean suggested we stop in Palomino along the way. We can do yoga and be all zen, he said. I was in. We'd be spending our coming days atop seaside cliffs, trekking across hot sand dunes and sleeping in hammocks. We could use the time in Palomino to prepare for the adventure. Palomino is the type of place where soul-searching European expats with dreadlocks come to find their vibe, or tribe, I should say. It's the type of place I tend to avoid. On our way into town, our taxi driver tells us it used to be quiet around here, a home for indigenous people. But in the last few years, travelers came flocking for the beachy vibe and nearby Sierra Nevada range. Developers came next, bringing yoga studios, vegan restaurants, and juice bars. After checking into our hotel, we head straight to the beach and spread out on the sand. The weather is perfect, the sky a clear blue. I play music on my phone, and Sean buys roasted nuts in an oil-stained brown paper bag from an elderly man. There are vendors everywhere. They sell arepas, fresh fruit, woven bags, and those patterned friendship bracelets seemingly everyone brings home from trips. A dark-skinned woman walks by holding up a binder full of images of Kim Kardashian wearing Bo Derek and boxer braids, claiming she can replicate the look for 50 mil pesos. A few feet away, I see a woman squeezing oil from what looks like an old bottle of dishwashing liquid onto a man's sunburned shoulders. She's crouched down on a small stool, and her firm brown hands are working on his back, kneading and slapping and pounding. She notices me watching and shouts, "You next, Mummy!" When she's done with the guy, she makes her way over to me. It's 25 mil pesos for 30 minutos y 50 mil pesos for una hora. Pero, you need una hora. You have a lot of body, like me, she says, gripping her thighs, which are as thick and shapely as mine. Our eyes met for a moment, and we burst out laughing, big open-mouthed cackles. You got me, girl, I say, lifting my arms in mock defeat. Brenda, she says, extending her hand. Glenn, I say. Brenda nods toward the image of a dark-skinned black woman with a big, juicy afro that's printed on my tote bag. She peels back her sun hat to reveal a puff of thick, coily hair and gives me a thumbs up. I knew we black people were here in Colombia, and I'd been hoping that somewhere along the journey I'd have a moment for this type of fellowship. So often, when I'm traveling, my hair, skin, and body are what set me apart. When I can connect my diasporic dots in the midst of it, I feel a strengthening sense of self, no matter where I am in the world. I am at home. Brenda proceeds to bend, crack, and snap my body into alignment. We're mostly quiet throughout, but when I flip onto my stomach, she taps my butt playfully and laughs. Mismo, mismo, same, same, and we start cackling all over again. She repeats this word when massaging my scalp, her hands deep into my afro. Mismo, she says, and then tienda, or linda, rather, for beautiful. She whispers it over and over, linda, linda, linda. When she's finished, I pass Brenda the 50 mil plus 20 more in respect for her hustle. She tucks the rolled-up bills into her bra. We sit together for a while. My Spanish isn't great, neither is her English, but we make do. I learn she's actually from Venezuela, but left 6 months ago to earn money to send back to her children, who stayed behind. Brenda is one of more than 4 million Venezuelans who've had to flee due to the country's ongoing political and economic crisis. Food's scarce, the dollar is hyperinflated, and death tolls are rising. Colombia es beautiful, pero Venezuela, Brenda sighs. Venezuela es sweet, she says, kissing her fingers to her lips. I look at her, thinking this town might be a little strange for the both of us, but in this moment we've found a sweet familiarity in each other. Sean and I had set off to Colombia in search of thrills, but as I'm constantly reminded on each of my journeys, adventures don't have to be about adrenaline and increased heart rate. They can be about the bravery it takes to reach across cultural divides and find commonalities. Brenda pulls a small Nokia from her fanny pack. The screen is slicked with massage oil. Mi hija, she says, pointing to a photo of a smiling brown girl on the home screen. Linda, I say. Kaylinda. By the way, the article about the dark rye bread that tastes of molasses and anise in Sweden by Jill Robinson, my grandmother and my mother had that same recipe. They were both of Swedish descent, and always fun to try that. Well, that brings us to the end of our journey on today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, and should be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-822-5138.